There's two lines in that hymn that we just sang that stand out to me. Interestingly enough, it's from the first verse and the last verse. The first verse, you all just sang the lyrics about the cross being the emblem of suffering and shame. And then at the end, we all proclaim together that to that old rugged cross, I will ever be true. Its shame and reproach gladly bear. So we sing about the cross representing suffering and shame, and we sing about sharing in those experiences. Yet this is the very thing that those early disciples and we ourselves have such a hard time wrapping our minds around. We wrestle with suffering. We wrestle with the shame that sometimes is associated with being a person of faith. And I think one of the most difficult questions to answer in life is probably, how can a good God allow bad things to happen? Even harder yet is experiencing suffering of any kind in our lives as individuals. And I think if we're honest, we try to avoid suffering at all costs. We see like the warning signs that suffering is coming. And so we think, well, something has to be off, so we got to change it so we don't have to go through that. But the way that we understand suffering should be impacted by our faith. So by now you've probably noticed that the characteristics of a cross-shaped life, we're in this series returning to cross-shaped Christianity, the characteristics of a cross-shaped life are more often than not countercultural. So like whatever the culture says, think of the opposite, and that's what a cross-shaped life looks like. So week one, we talked about this idea. Returning to a cross-shaped Christianity requires that we move away from a serve-us mentality to a life of service. Week two, we said returning to a cross-shaped Christianity requires us to show hospitality to strangers and foreigners. Last week, we said returning to cross-shaped Christianity requires that we abandon attempts at self-exaltation and practice self-emptying and humility. And these countercultural characteristics will cause us to stick out and look different than the rest of the world around us. And when we look different, when we stick out, what happens is we should expect to suffer a little bit just because of that. I think there's this thought that's pushed in the church sometimes that if I just choose Jesus, everything will be okay. I think when we sing songs like the old rugged cross, in the back of our mind, there's this thought that, well, he suffered, so I don't have to. So the very first time that we experience like really difficult suffering, we're tempted to either question the goodness of God, or we may even question the own validity of our own faith. Well, do I really have faith if I'm suffering? But this is the point that I want to help you all understand this morning about a cross-shaped Christianity. Returning to cross-shaped Christianity requires that we see suffering differently, that we understand suffering different than the rest of the world. In John chapter 16, verse 33, Jesus encouraged his followers with these words. Now notice I say encourage, but listen to the words. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world. The word that Jesus used is a Greek word that is often translated as tribulation, affliction, persecution, anguish. The literal meaning of the Greek word is actually like pressing together or pressure, friction. And so what Jesus is saying here is the idea is we don't want to run from it. We don't want to avoid it. We shouldn't try to escape it. Cross-shaped people should endure it. And I think that's the key between a life of faith and a life of no faith. Faithful people endure suffering. Consider these texts from the New Testament. And Jesus again saying this, Matthew chapter 10, verse 22. You will be hated by everyone because of me, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. James puts it this way, and it's most likely the half-brother of Jesus, same mom, different dad. You're supposed to laugh, that's a joke. James chapter 1, verse 12. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial. Having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw everything off that hinders us and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. Now notice this part. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now notice how the author of Hebrews is pressing the readers to possess the character of endurance simply because Jesus endured the cross. And then Paul wrote this to his letter to the Philippians in chapter 3, verse 10. I want to know Christ. Yes, to know the power of his resurrection. And notice what Paul says. And participation in his suffering. Becoming like him in his death. Notice, Paul is like inviting. Like, if I want to know Christ, I have to participate in suffering. It has to be a part of who I am to be like him, to really know him. And so my question is, how do we get to that point? How do we become like Paul and say, like, bring it on? Let me experience it, because I know when I do that, I will be more like him. How can we have a more holy understanding of suffering? Now, I want to be clear. The Bible addresses several different kinds of suffering, right? And some of the texts, maybe the majority of the texts that we read, are related to suffering for the sake of Christ, like being persecuted for your faith, looked at differently by the culture around you because of the values you have as a follower of Jesus. But the Bible also addresses suffering due to the brokenness of the world. When you read the story of creation, you'll find that all of creation is under a curse. And because creation is cursed, we deal with things like sickness, disease, relational issues, and the list can go on and on and on. And these are part of living in a broken world. But that's still suffering. The Bible, I believe, also addresses what I would call undeserved suffering, where we suffer because not related to any decision or action that we've made, but we're called collateral damage. We suffer because somebody else makes bad decisions or has unholy actions. And so one of the things that I think we have to come to understand about suffering is this, and I would encourage you to write this down. All suffering is not the same, but God allows all of our suffering to sanctify us. All suffering is not the same, but God allows all of our suffering to sanctify us. Now, I want to be careful here in the words that I choose. And notice I said God allows it, because I don't believe that God is the direct cause of all suffering, but ultimately everything passes through his fingertips. And so he allows this suffering. But I also know that there's a huge difference between Christ's sufferings and our own suffering. And so when we look at the cross, we think, well, he suffered, so I don't have to. That's not exactly the case. And here's why I say that. Because Christ's sufferings were to save us. Our sufferings don't save us. Our sufferings sanctify us. And here's what, to put it another way, this is how I would say it. Jesus suffered so that we could be in a relationship with God through him. God then allows us to suffer to shape us and mold us to be more like him. I think it was C.S. Lewis that said it like this. God willingly became a human. God became a human so I could be, God became like me so I could become like him. That's how he said it. God became like me so I could become like him. And it's really easy for us to have a problem with God allowing us to experience pain or suffering of any kind if that suffering or pain is pointless. If there's no point behind the pain, then it's easy to have a problem with God. But enduring suffering becomes tolerable when we realize that God has a purpose in the pain. Now, we have to remember that God's ultimate goal for our lives is not for us to be happy. God does not want us to be happy. He wants us to be holy. There's a difference. A life free from suffering would certainly lead to a happy life. But the bigger question is, if we lived a life free of suffering, would we ever reach a holy life? C.S. Lewis does quite a bit of work on this issue of pain and suffering in two works. He has a pamphlet that he wrote called A Grief Observed, and then he wrote a little booklet called The Problem with Pain. And he wrote those works out of his own suffering of losing someone that was very close to him. And the observation that he makes about people in general is that sometimes people want God to be more like a grandfather than a father. Right? And I know from my own experience as a grandchild and now having kids who have grandparents that when you send the kids to the grandparents' house, they're really not going to get a lot of discipline. And they're not going to be told no very often because the grandparents want their grandkids to be happy. And so when the kids come home and all of a sudden now dad's like, hey, no, you're so mean. Well, that's because my goal for my kids is not for them to be happy all the time. My goal for them is to be productive adults when they grow up. And that means you have to learn that there are times when you can't have everything that you want. You can't do everything that you want. And C.S. Lewis says that's how we view God. Like, we want God to be our grandfather. But he's not. He's our father. And so his ultimate goal is not for us to be happy. Sometimes he has to tell us no. Sometimes he has to allow us to suffer in order to get us out of the nursery. I want to bring up an Old Testament example. I think how this works beautifully. You can read about the life of Joseph in Genesis chapter 37 through 50. And I'm not going to read all of those chapters to you, but I'm going to give you my version. If I were writing the story, like summarizing it, this is how I would tell you. Joseph was the son of Jacob. Jacob, we know, is the one that wrestled with God, and God said, I'm going to call you Israel. And so his children become the 12 tribes of Israel. And what we're told about Jacob and Joseph's relationship is interesting. We are told in Genesis 37:3 that Jacob loved Joseph more than his other sons because Joseph was born to him when he was older. Now, I'm sure you can imagine if you have siblings, this is going to cause a problem. All right, I can remember thinking when I was younger that I was the favorite. So Joseph's brothers were jealous. And then Joseph had a couple dreams that he probably should have kept to himself, but he didn't. All right, so he made things worse. And Joseph's brothers, one day, they're out tending the sheep. And Jacob says to Joseph, hey, you need to go check in. Make sure your brothers are okay. The brothers see Joseph coming and they concoct this plan. And initially the plan is we're going to kill him. We're going to kill him and then we're going to tell Dad that some wild animal must have eaten him. But Reuben, which is, Jacob had a couple different wives, and Reuben was a whole brother. How would you say that? Same dad, same mom. Full brother. Reuben was a full brother. He's like, no, wait, let's not kill him. Let's just throw him in this pit. And Reuben's plan was, I'm going to come back and get him out. The problem was, before he could do that, there was a caravan traveling to Egypt, and the other brothers saw the opportunity to make a little cash. And so they said, hey, we're going to sell him to them into slavery. And so they do. Joseph ends up in Egypt as a slave. Now, when he gets there, you know, he's at the lowest of lows in his life at that point, I would say. He gets there and he kind of climbs out of that pit just a little bit. He finds a favor with a man named Potiphar, who he owned Joseph as a slave, but he treated him well. And Joseph, you know, was liked by Potiphar. Unfortunately, Potiphar's wife also liked Joseph a little too much. And she wanted, you know, to have some relations with Joseph, and Joseph wasn't having any of it. And that made her mad, so she accused him of crossing the line. And this lands Joseph in an Egyptian prison. So here we have this roller coaster of life. Low, high, back to low in prison. When he's in prison, he comes across two other guys that were thrown in prison. And these guys have dreams. And Joseph has some experience with dreams. So he interprets their dreams for them. And he tells them, hey, remember me. When you get out, remember me that I could do. And unfortunately, they didn't really remember him until a while later when Pharaoh has a dream. And one of the guys that he interpreted the dream was close to Pharaoh. He said, hey, I know a guy. I remember this guy when I was in prison. He interpreted my dream and it came true. And so Joseph comes in, and now we see this ascent back to, you know, the top. And Joseph's able to interpret the dream. And he's brought in as an advisor. And because he was able to interpret the dream, he was also able to help them prepare for a severe famine that was going to come. And Joseph rose to like a really, really high position. Some commentators will tell you like he may have been number two in Egypt. And then we get another side of the story where Joseph's family, those brothers that wanted to kill him and sold him into slavery, well, guess what? They were hungry because of this famine. Back in Canaan, the famine reached that far and they had no food, but they heard there was food in Egypt. So their dad, Jacob, sends them to Egypt to buy food. And wouldn't you know it that they end up buying food from old Joseph. Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. So Joseph devises his own plan to get his brothers to come back for more food. Now, I'm cutting a lot of details out, but when they come back, he reveals himself to them. And the brothers are terrified. They are terrified because of how they treated him. And Joseph makes a statement. I'm going to find it. I want to read it to you exactly how he says it. It's in Genesis 45. And I find it very interesting how he says this. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one who you sold into Egypt." Now listen to this. "Now don't be distressed and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, to save your lives by a great deliverance." Now that's the first time. They come down to, the whole family comes down to Egypt to live. And Jacob actually dies there in Egypt, their father. And when dad dies, the brothers are afraid again. Well, now dad's not alive, so he's not here to keep the peace. And now this is, Joseph's probably going to kill us now. And Joseph says this in response. "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." So this is how he reassures them, I'm not gonna take revenge. You know, Joseph's life is like ours in a lot of ways. There are times when it feels like things are just going great. Everything is as it should be. We're happy. And there's also plenty of times when we feel sorrow, when we experience suffering, and we just don't understand. But one thing that we can learn from Joseph is that there are people in life. I mean, there's a whole evil force in life that desires to do evil, to harm us. But God is so powerful that he can use evil for a greater good. Now, was it easy for Joseph to suffer? No, I don't think so. I don't think that was an easy life at all. Did Joseph understand why he was suffering during the suffering? I don't think so. I don't think he understood why he was in that pit until much later in his life. He probably didn't understand everything that was going on until his brother showed back up on his doorstep ready to die because they needed food. That's probably when it sunk in. Wow. Okay, God, I see what you were doing here. God was allowing him to suffer to save his people. And what we see in Joseph is that because he endured the suffering, man, we see a lot of the characteristics of Jesus in Joseph. Don't be afraid. I'm not going to harm you. I forgive you. I mean, you tried to kill me, but I'm going to let it go. And so because he endured, it allowed him to see God at work. Now I want you to consider these words from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. Peter's writing to people that are experiencing suffering. And he writes this: "In all this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief and all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed." And so what Peter is reminding these people, and I think maybe it would help all of us to be reminded, is that though we may suffer in this life, something greater is coming. Something greater is coming. And the suffering that we experience in this life is preparing us not just to receive that, but to be fit for that something greater. Returning to cross-shaped Christianity requires us to see suffering differently. All suffering is not the same, but God allows all of our suffering to sanctify us. God allows suffering in our life to shape us, not to break us. Remember that. He allows the suffering to shape us, not to break us. He is present in the pain, and he has a purpose in the pain. And all he asks is that we endure it to the end. Let's pray. Father, we are not absent to suffering. We know that righteous people experience suffering, unrighteous people experience suffering. But you allow us to experience that suffering to shape us and mold us into the image of Jesus Christ. The image that we tarnished through our own sin. You loved us so much that you willingly died for us, but you also love us so much that you refused to leave us in the position that you found us in. Help us to have a different perspective of suffering and be people that suffer well, knowing that the temporal characteristic of suffering in this life is far outweighed by eternity in your presence. I ask these things in Jesus' name.